We ended the last episode with this. Europe was a seething cauldron by 1500. It was ready to boil over. And the realms of economics, politics, education, and religion, time had come for change. All that was needed was someone who could, well, mold these explosive elements into a single movement. Such a movement could, and eventually would, cover Europe. Here's what provided the heat, boiling that kettle. The Western European Church of the 14th, 15th centuries experienced a major crisis of authority. That crisis came from challenges both within and without. They combined to plant seeds of doubt in the minds of many about the legitimacy of church leaders. The 70-year-long relocation of the papacy from Rome to France was one that everyone knew was a matter of politics, not piety. This papal schism that saw at first two and then eventually three rivals all claiming to be pope. The Council of Constance ended the schism, but the solution raised serious questions about the authority of the papacy, further dividing church leaders and distressing the people of Europe. In addition to these political shenanigans, the church was marked by widespread corruption and fraud. Simony, the buying and selling of ecclesiastical offices, was common. Immorality among monks, priests, bishops, and cardinals was at times and places not even hidden. The church spent a fortune acquiring thousands of relics for its cathedrals and paying for them with the selling of indulgences, a practice that many were, well, deeply uncomfortable with. The Inquisition terrorized whole regions of Europe, especially in Spain, and while the church justified his actions by saying that it was rooting out dangerous heresy, many knew that some victims of the Inquisition were innocent. The church simply wanted their property and wealth, and had used the Inquisition as a means of enriching itself. With the birth of the Renaissance and a new open-mindedness about thinking outside the realm of official authority, the church became an object of ridicule and satire in pamphlets and books that were readily available with the invention of the printing press. Now, let me be clear. Some of the harshest criticism of the church came not from outsiders, but from faithful priests and monks who were disgusted with the corruption and error that they saw among their peers. As a reaction to the stultifying academic pursuits of scholasticism, well, there was a popular movement all across Europe known as mysticism, in which people simply wanted to, well, feel their faith and sought to make contact with the divine through meditation and a more personal link to God than going through the official priesthood. With the Bible being translated into the languages of different Europeans, people no longer had to rely on a priest telling them what it said. The 16th century world was one of astonishing change. Medieval civilization, dominated by an institutional church, was disappearing. Modern nation-states challenged the church for political and economic supremacy, and the voyages of discovery made the world seem smaller at the same time that new worlds were opening. The Renaissance of northern Italy saw many turn from a hidebound and superstitious Catholicism to the romanticized glories of ancient Greece and Rome. Into this challenging world stepped one, Desiderius Erasmus, who almost perfectly embodied the emerging spirit of the age. He honored the faith legacy of Christianity while embracing an openness to new things. If I may use an illustration, think of a grand European cathedral. It's an amazing expression of religious faith, but its walls are heavy, it's dark inside. Erasmus loved that cathedral and honored the faith that it represented, but he wanted more light to shine inside it so that others could see its beauty. And so he opened wide the doors and cleaned the windows to let more light in. Now, taking the pulse of the times, Erasmus ridiculed the Catholic Church with biting satire. His works were widely popular. In his most famous, called The Praise of Folly, written in 1509, Erasmus took jabs at the church's immorality, corruption, and decadence. He ridiculed such superstitions as fanatical devotion to relics, stories of bleeding communion bread, and the cult of the saints. In another work, he depicted St. Peter railing against Pope Julius II for his luxurious and opulent lifestyle and military conquests. But it was in 1516 that Erasmus published his most important and influential work. It was a Greek edition of the New Testament. He examined and compared the available manuscripts and citations from the Church Fathers. And the result was an accurate New Testament Greek text that became the New Testament of the Reformation. One epigram regarding the Reformation says that Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched. The illegitimate son of a Dutch priest, Erasmus lived in search of knowledge, in pursuit of piety, and in love with books. He also was oppressed by the fear of poverty. Along the way, his writings and scholarship started a theological earthquake that didn't stop until European Christendom was torn in two. Born in Rotterdam and orphaned by the plague, Erasmus was sent from the school of St. Lebuns, which taught classical learning and the humanities, to a school that was run by the Brethren of the Common Life. There, he learned an emphasis on a personal relationship with God, but he detested the strict rules of the monastic life and intolerant theologians. They intended to teach humility, he later recalled, by breaking students' spirits. Well, being poor, with no prospects, Erasmus joined the Augustinians. He wanted to travel. He wanted to gain some academic elbow room and leave behind the, as he called them, barbarians who discouraged him from classical studies. As soon as he was ordained a priest in 1492, he became secretary to the Bishop of Cambrai, who sent him to Paris to study theology. He hated it there, too. The dorm rooms stank of urine, the food was atrocious, which is interesting because it was French. Studies were mechanical, and the discipline was brutal. He began a career in writing and traveling that took him to most of the countries of Europe. Though his health was often poor, Erasmus was driven by a desire to seek out the best theologians of his day. On a trip to England in 1499, he complained of bad beer, the uncouth nature of the English, and the terrible weather. But he met Sir Thomas More, who he became friends with for life. Now, on that same trip, he heard John Collet teach from the scriptures, not just quote from the commentaries that he'd studied in Paris. Collet, who later became the dean of St. Paul's, encouraged Erasmus to become a primitive theologian. That is, someone who studied scripture like the church fathers had, not like the argumentative scholastics who had dominated theology for the last century. So Erasmus devoted himself to learning the Koine, or the common Greek, in which the New Testament was written. And the result was his most significant work, an edition of the New Testament in original Greek, published in 1516. Accompanying it were study notes as well as his own Latin translation, which corrected over 600 errors in Jerome's Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible that had reigned supreme from the early centuries to that time. Now, two of the most noteworthy praises of Erasmus's work came from Pope Leo X and from the German monk we know as Martin Luther, who a year later, after the publication of his Greek New Testament, launched the Reformation. Now, before that turning point, however, which would eventually consume Erasmus, he became famous for his other writings, and there were plenty of them to be famous for. By the 1530s, some 15% of all books sold were written by Erasmus. Historians refer to Erasmus as a humanist, but that label has a very different meaning than it does today. A humanist in the 15th century referred to someone who studied the humanities, the social sciences of language and art, history, other subjects concerned with culture and society. But Erasmus was too brilliant a mind to simply study the humanities. He felt an obligation to better society, and so he wrote to confront and correct the errors that he felt had crept into the church, an institution that he knew had by far the biggest chance in shaping culture. He found that he had great skill in the use of satire to make his point, and people enjoyed reading his books and tracts. Those books brought him fame, as did his Greek New Testament. This and his attacks on the church caught Martin Luther's attention, who wrote asking for support. Now, the two never met, but their fates were intertwined. Erasmus's enemies accused him of inspiring Luther, who was accused of breaking up God's church. Erasmus found much that he liked in Luther's writing, describing him to Pope Leo X as, quote, a mighty trumpet of gospel truth, unquote. But at the same time, he privately told his printer to stop printing Luther's writings because he didn't want his own efforts to be identified with Luther's. For 4 years, Erasmus pleaded for moderation on both sides of the divide that Luther's work had caused. When pressed, he sided with the Pope. But still, he hated the bickering and the intolerance of both sides, saying, quote, I detest dissension because it goes both against the teachings of Christ and against a secret inclination of nature. I doubt that either side in the dispute can be suppressed without grave loss. It is clear that many of the reforms for which Luther calls are urgently needed, unquote. His mediating position satisfied neither side. He said, quote, "My only wish is that now that I am old, I may be allowed to enjoy the results of my efforts. But both sides reproach me and seek to coerce me. Some claim that since I do not attack Luther, I agree with him, while the Lutherans declare that I am a coward who has forsaken the gospel," unquote. Indeed, Luther attacked him as a Moses who would die in the wilderness without entering the promised land, and the Roman Church banned his writings.